Dear future, I'm ready to be vulnerable.
This is Dear Future, I'm Ready, a podcast brought to you from Amsterdam by Digital Society School and Transformational Studio. Your hosts for today are Carola Vashore and Marco van Hout. Together, they bring new questions for topics that are still largely unanswered, engaging with thought leaders on transformational topics that open up the conversation and the exploration of what's next as we navigate the 21st century, so that we can all say, Dear Future, I'm ready.
Welcome to Dear Future, I'm Ready. Today we talk to Kees Klomp, who's a professor of purpose economy at Rotterdam University of Applied Sciences, where he researches and develops an existential approach to economics. Kees is co-founder of Thrive Institute, an organization that aims to reinvent economics and society. He's a recognized voice in topics of transformation and new ways of thinking and solving for the complex times we live in. In his latest book, Thrive, Fundamentals for a New Economy, Kees and co-author Shinta Oosterwaal provide insights into alternative approaches to economics that are sustainable and just for both society and the planet in the long term. Welcome to our podcast, Kees.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Kees. It's wonderful to have you with us. As you know, our 21 for 21 podcast is a podcast about transformation. And this is important because we are in a time of big transitions. Even before the transformation is done and dusted, we need to transition. And that means we're living in old models and also in new models at the same time to varying degrees. Things are changing. People and planet need to thrive together. But we also need to think about, what is society? What is our role within it? And what is the role within the broader ecosystems of meaning and the bigger narrative? This is why we are talking to 21 transformational leaders like yourself, who can tell us what is going on and what the view is like when you are ahead of the curve. And we are talking to you today about the purpose economy, or perhaps better said, existential economics, and about impact and about integral value creation. Quite frankly, I can't wait. So, Kees, tell us, how do you see things these days? What is the role of humans in this bigger loop? What is the role of our intrinsic motivation as the world crumbles around us and we get perhaps a bit somber about the outlook? What is our role in the bigger ecology?
Well, there is a role that we are currently playing, and there is a role that we should be playing. And I think that the main difference between these two is called crisis. And so I think that the potential for a thriving society and answers is in alignment. Yeah? So I think one of the most important things that we can learn from an ecological perspective on things is that we have to align to the living principles and patterns that are out there. And so if we take nature as a source of inspiration, we can learn from billions of years of wisdom we can find in nature. And what we basically have done for the last millions of years is to try to conquer and control these principles and patterns, and it just doesn't work like that. And so I think the main message and the main job that we have to do as human beings is to align with the bigger picture. And if we know how to align, we will become part of the thriving living system, because life by itself is by definition regenerative and flourishing. Yeah, so there's a lot of prosperity ahead. The only problem is that we have the tendency to only perceive the world in an anthropocentric perspective, whereas we need an ecocentric perspective. But we can do this.
I love that. I think it makes me feel really optimistic, but I think that there's also a realist within me that says, are we ready as humans to admit that we just don't know? And are we willing to either remember or, you know, reconnect with an intelligence that is bigger, broader, wider, deeper than us? because that is an act of humility, wouldn't you say?
I totally agree. That's the reason that crisis is a necessity and also an opportunity. Yeah, so crisis means, and that is also the reason why I position my theory, my practice as existential economics, because I think the main carrier, the main driver of change is the acceptance of, let's say, the cross point that that happens when you acknowledge the fact that you are part of something bigger. Yeah, so the acknowledgement of interbeing, basically, that life on Earth, by definition, which is it's even a scientific fact, is an interconnected, related sphere. Yeah? So everything on this planet is part of the same system and needs each other to coexist. And if we acknowledge that fact and start to live and act according to this realization, that is when we start to experience meaning. So there is a correlation between the existence and our existence. And so people perceive and experience meaning when they act in service of this bigger realm that we can connect with, which is called interbeing. So, I call this. For me, the Holy Trinity is interseeing, which means that we comprehend the fact that life on Earth is by fact interconnected and interrelated. And when we acknowledge that, we experience interbeing. And when we start to act according to this realization, we practice interliving. And interliving is based upon the fact that you act in a symbiotic, mutualistic way. And our problem is that when you look at the natural world, it's full of symbiotic and mutual relationships. In any ecosystem, it's full of them. We are an exception. Yeah? So we have a very destructive relationship with a lot of other living creatures on this planet, and this is problematic. Yeah. So we have to acknowledge the fact that we need to become flourishing, constructive parts of the bigger sphere rather than being the destructive, problematic ones.
So a couple of things I take out of your response. So you talk about meaning.
Yes.
That's a very important one. And relationships, and they interconnect. And you also mentioned interbeing. And what I think is that if you talk about meaning, it's about understanding also and interpretation. And the same for relationships. And you talk about a relationship with nature, with our ecological system. How can we actually make the voice of our ecological system heard in the way that we actually can make something out of that and to actually be in a relationship? Otherwise, it's never a balanced relationship when you're on the same terms.
Well, it's training, basically. It's training. Yeah? So if we can learn a lot from our indigenous brothers and sisters. Yeah? So they have no problem whatsoever to tune in to the mountain or the tree or to the fox whatsoever. You know, it will take them a mini second to experience a living relationship with, I don't know, the river, for instance. The problem is that we have distanced ourselves for hundreds of years from nature. And this is basically the evil of the modern times and the Enlightenment. We created a distance, a dualism between us and nature. But the good news is, we are still nature. We might not experience it like that. We might think different, but truth is, we are part of the living system. We are nature. We are nothing more and nothing less than fungi, foxes, and plants, yeah, for instance. We might think of ourselves as a unique species with a unique form of intelligence and all the other stuff. But intelligence is also up for discussion. because plants and fungi have been there for billions of years, and they evolved and succeeded to overcome all sorts of big changes. And well, we are well on our way to extinct ourselves.
Yeah.
So what is intelligent?
Oh my God, that's a big one.
But the good news is we can train the experience of interconnectedness and interbeing with other living beings. It's trainable.
So this is interesting because training is exactly what we do here at a digital science school, for example. what do you think then is the role of education of a school like ours? How would we actually have to evolve our educational system in order to train everybody on this? What's needed?
We both work at universities of applied science, so that means that we have two big subjects that we focus on, which is knowledge and applying that knowledge. And so we teach our students, we will give them all sorts of information and education materials where they can train their brains with, and then we also teach them how to use those methods and those theories in practice. What we don't teach them is, one could say, the knowledge of the heart. There is very ample room for attitude to engage in relationships with whether that is a social community or an ecological community. So I think the one of the biggest challenges we have in education is to also acknowledge the fact that the heart, the experience, the basis for connection with other living forms of living on the planet,
yeah,
is part of being human, and therefore should also be part of being a student.
And for that, we probably need to go outside, right, and not stay in our classrooms.
That helps.
At the very least, we need to get out of our heads.
Yes.
So I think that part of what you've just touched upon, which is so fascinating, and obviously, Case, that we read a lot of the same authors and are influenced by many of the same thinkers. But we've had the privilege in this podcast to have Nora Bateson, who is the daughter of Gregory Bateson. Correct. And that's what Nora, as a pioneer, works on. But her father previously, Gregory Bateson, had indeed a view that was ecological, very much like yourself. And he also focused on the intrinsic motivation of humans as learners, because actually we have to not look at it as an either or, Bateson would have said, but we have to look at it as a both and really activate our curiosity and our multi-layered intelligence in order to connect and to go into the interliving space that you just talked about.
Yeah.
I think this is perhaps the biggest challenge of our times is how can we go where we've never been? How can we imagine what our hearts desire, but we don't yet know how to help make happen?
Yeah.
Because we keep acting from limitations in our beliefs, limitations in the abilities of other beings and other species on our planet. So how do we break that mold? Because you're talking about this can be trained, but it's not just a penny that drops, is it? It's a habit. It's a way we organize our society, the way we live.
Yeah,
do we do that?
Well, I had a talk a couple of months ago with Matthijs Schouten, who's an ecologist, of course, and also a philosopher. And what he said, and I think that's a very really vivid description of the challenge that we have. He said, if you take ecology, you can train ecology in exactly the same way that we train our students right now, which is with a big emphasis on rationality and reductionism. He basically said, if you approach ecology like that, you won't find any solutions in it. So you go into a forest, and if you study the forest as a rational ecologist, nothing will happen. So he said, you need something more. And what he basically says is you have to relate to the forest. So you have to get acquainted with the forest. You have to immerse in the forest. And once you get, you start to experience a relationship, and that's why I use the term existential. It has to be, I have to internalize the information. It has to become part of me. Then everything changes, because then it's not only a tree anymore, which is part of a bigger problem, which is related to fungi underneath and turns water into oxygen and all that. No, you start to see life, and you start to see how life is connected and how you are connected to the other forms of life. And that is basically our biggest challenge. Yeah. And the problem is that our system is based upon the head and the hands, and forgets the heart. And you need the heart to make the head and the hands do constructive stuff in service of life and beyond self-interest. So I think that is a wonderful example. Can you see life in the forest rather than only the system and the actors within the system? Because if you only see the system and the actors in the system from a rational perspective rather than from an emotional perspective, nothing changes. Yeah. So that is, for me, the essence of existential economics. You have to be touched.
So yeah, exactly. So apart from just a growing habit, it's actually indeed a transformation in itself, yeah, that you undergo. So transformation is, of course, the main theme of our podcast. So apart from this definition, what, in your words, is transformation in the story of the existential economics? What's the transformation that we focus on?
Well, so I connect personal transformation to societal transition. Yeah? Mm. So we have the tendency to look at this time and era and call it the great transition. And so it's all about transition. Mm. And basically the definition of transition is a fundamental change in paradigm. Yeah? So you have a current situation and you have a new situation, and the new situation is fundamentally different from the old situation, and the process in between is called a transition.
Right.
In that process, you have to change as well. Yeah? So and we have the tendency to start with behavior. So we start to emphasize to people that they have to change this and that. And this is all what we see in sustainability and in corporate social responsibility. Do this, do that. But what we don't do, or do a lot less, is to go way back, all the way deep, deep down in people's belief systems. Yeah. And start to ask, so how does this correlate with my self-image? And how does this correlate with my worldview? And how does this correlate to my perception of relationships? And I think that especially this transition that we are going through, which is so fundamental, it is called the great mind shift. It's been called the great transition. It's called the great turning by Joanna Macy. And all these elements use the word great because it is the biggest change that we as living beings have gone through for the bigger part of the history of mankind. It's utterly fundamental. And yet, we tend to only focus on behavior and forget what it does to.
So is that also the difference that I've heard you say that in Dutch, the difference between betekenis and bedoeling, meaning and purpose?
Purpose, yes, yeah? It is. Yeah. Yes, yes.
That describes that.
Yes. And so to put it very simple, so we have a system in order now, a paradigm in order, which basically told us to do certain things, pursue self-interest, be strong individuals, create monetary success, welfare is everything, all these elements, you know them by now. And our complete society is based upon these beliefs. And now we are entering a period where we basically have to come to the conclusion that all these truths, all these beliefs don't fit the future narrative anymore. Because we don't need welfare, we need well-being. We don't need individual success, we need collective success. We don't need constant growth, but we need thrive. Yeah. And a lot of people are not able to translate these new rules for engagement with their own belief system, because they basically grew up with a completely different personality trait. And I think this is the biggest problem. And you can basically see it now happening in COVID, where people have to change their behavior in a nick of time, and we don't acknowledge the fact what that does to people. Yeah. So we give them orders, but we don't give them perspective. And you basically see it derail in front of your eyes.
Yeah.
Because people are not able to do it because they don't believe in it.
Yeah. So this relates to imagination, right, Carola? That's your topic, imagination. You always talk about imagination. Yeah.
Yes, moral imagination.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, moral imagination. Because as Case is touching upon, transformation happens for two reasons. Either the urgency is very big, and we call that a crisis, which is potentially and very likely the situation we are in as humankind, because, you know, the planet is going to keep spinning with us or without us. We're the ones that are kind of in a bit of a meddle here and a bit of a problem here. The other option is, of course, transformation occurs because there is something so appealing, so visionary, so beautiful, so powerful, so mobilizing, so linked to our values and beliefs that we want to make it happen.
Yeah.
And the minute we understand interbeing, the minute we understand interliving, the minute we can reconnect to that, what happens is, it has been said by an author in the spiritual practice, what happens is we remember, meaning we become a member again. It's not just remembering, but
beautiful.
It's realizing and becoming a member again. The world, the other species, everything else never thought otherwise about us. It was us that were in this kind of vacuum of, you know, self orientation and busy with ourselves, that we forgot that we belong. And if we are able to connect to that and really kind of shed roots from our value system, then this is perhaps the most vitalizing force that can exist. If we engage with the vitality that comes from human values that connect to the human heart, then our possibilities are expansive, because we are already good with our heads and our hands, to continue on Case's analogy. But now it's not just an either or, it's a both and. It's and we can have welfare because we do, and we can have well-being because we understand that welfare alone doesn't work. Welfare together, welfare connected, is welfare for all. And so this is, it's really an organic and ecological point of view. I'm not speaking as a socialist here. I'm speaking as someone who says we understand that we are part of a connected web of all kinds of beings, and that when we share, we multiply. And this is so visceral in the understanding that it must be linked to values, because if it doesn't have that visceral element, it misses the vitality that is a key requirement for sparkling the imagination. So that's just kind of mirroring back much of the beautiful work that you do to you, Case. But, you know, I think that we really are in a time in which we more and more need to inspire one another and really need to help create visions by doing, by showing that it's possible, by even the smallest acts, if they are linked to values, they become choices that we make as beings of this planet instead of choices that we make as consumers.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of power in that.
Yeah, and also really important is that, so if you take the transition theory by Derek Lorbach and Jan Rotmans with the cross, mm-hmm. So what we are now discussing is basically the undertow that basically now emerges and becomes stronger and stronger, and you see that the regime, the current norm is decreasing in power. But one of the key elements of making the undertow stronger and making sure that the new regime takes place is visibility. And whether we like it or not, mainstream media is playing an important role in withholding the new stories and the new narrative from the mainstream. Yeah? So the mainstream media is really a big part of the problem. It feeds on, for instance, if you take COVID, you know, the media play a really, really important role in spreading a negative narrative, yeah, rather than giving room for a narrative that is much more on a shared experience, vulnerability, you know, all the other elements, and this is only COVID, you know. It's same goes for climate. They turn it into a black white pro anti discussion, whereas we need more stories about people that, you know, that take the leap, that try to work towards solutions. And a lot of people don't hear and see those stories amazing. So that's why it's also important to make podcasts like this, because we need to spread the stories. We need to weave the stories.
Yeah. And then the danger is, of course, that also with this podcast, I know we have a lot of listeners and we love them, but we put this on a platform and it's part of our little bubble. Yeah. So the big tech algorithms don't help either.
No, I agree.
So we're also, even if we're doing all this, we're not visible enough outside of these bubbles.
Yeah, but be aware. And this is something I just told you that before I came here in this studio, I was teaching a class in impact science, which I've been doing for a couple of years. And one of the most important things that I teach these students is don't mistake impact for you know, the big sensational stories. You know,
right.
it creating impact is not. Doesn't mean that everybody needs to become Bojan Slot and create the ocean cleanup. You know, if you are able to impact your family or your street or your city or your neighborhood in a positive way, that is as visible and as impactful as the bigger elements. And this is also part of the narrative, because especially in climate, in biodiversity, you know, there is a wrong narrative going on, that, you know, who are we as individuals to change? This is part of the politics. This is part of the government. They have to change. This is part of the corporates. And it's all true.
Yeah.
But it's equally true that if, for instance, each and everybody would stop eating meat, we would end the meat industry. It would go down the drain, and we would have a big, huge impact, very positive impact on climate change. So there's also a form of comfort in pointing the finger to the government and saying, you know, climate change is such a big problem, I will never be able to help it. That's bullshit.
Yeah.
You can have 100% impact on climate change just by doing things differently.
It's part of the narrative in that it's still dualistic. Yeah, as you know, Case, I am Argentinian and I'm a vegetarian. And that is a source of a lot of jokes. Because obviously I come from a vegan.
Remember this for some jokes.
But I come from a beef eating country, and that's great. But when people ask me, why do you do that? And I explain it from my heart, it becomes contagious, not because I'm trying to convince others to become vegetarians. That's their choice. But they start thinking, what might I do? And this in itself is what we need to start engaging with one another, in telling these stories that are not showing people this is what you must do, this is the only way, but this is one possible way, because that becomes a rallying call of what are other possible ways, which is how organic things develop. It's how ecology develops.
Totally agree.
Yeah. Hey, so we're talking about this right now, but of course we want to get people ready and trained for this for the near future. And I've heard you said this over and over that the time is now. Yes. But what's the timing of our actions and what's the timing of our impact? Can you say something about that?
Well, I think any action has a direct impact by itself. Mm-hmm. So if you stop eating meat today, that has a direct impact. Will your decision to stop eating meat put the meat industry down the drain right away? No, of course not.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, you made a decision and it will have an effect. Yeah? So that is one of the very fundamental lessons of Matthijs Schouten. You can't be without impact. Just the fact that you live and the fact that you are interconnected with everything else makes every decision that you do meaningful and makes it matter in, and not in a romantic or symbolic way, but in a very direct way that you influence the bigger picture.
But how important is it then to have a visual? You talked about visibility, a visual of that impact right away, because I also know that we're becoming carbon neutral right now, even means that we will still be in trouble for over a long period of time, tens of years, hundreds of years, I even think, and that it will just continue to influence our climate.
Well, what I prefer and what I also suggest is basically to pick up what Carola just mentioned, that if you become, for instance, as an Argentina, in, from a meat-eating country, becoming a vegetarian by heart, that resonates with other people. Yeah? So the heart recognize each other through resonation. You know, you become enthused by something else and you start to pick up. The problem with the data, that warm data, so you could say, is that it's quite hard to pinpoint. So what we start to do, and this is also, I think, one of the challenges ahead, is that we translate these that impact data in quite conventional data. So if you take a look at most impact reports of organizations, you basically see the same language being used as in financial reporting. But then with other metrics, with other indicators and with other scores. But it's basically a bunch of numbers. Mm-hmm. And this is also something that we don't take, we don't have another look at it. We just take it for granted. So this is this is basically the way that we have to communicate impact with each other. It's a matter of percentages. It's a matter of numbers. And but if you let that narrative go, if you let that belief system go, it opens a huge room to communicate in many other ways. Because the arts are another way of communicating. Art communicates. So why not communicate impact through art? And there are lots of reasons to not do it, because we say no, that's not, art is not a proper language. Mm. That, you know, you can't use art in an impact report. But I think that we hinder ourselves and we hinder the potential of what impact could be through our language. So if you ask me, how do we know we do enough? That is very much based upon a belief, narrative, that you have to show that what you are doing will change the world, rather than acknowledging the fact that whatever you do changes the world. Yeah. Because there
is, you better do something positive.
Yes, there are, every action means something and influences the bigger sphere. Mm. Yeah, so it's basically an illusion that we have created ourselves, that if we put a number on it and if we capture it into a diagram,
means something.
It means something.
That's brilliant. I like that. I like art because art as a form of expression goes beyond language, and therefore yes. It becomes a way of taking that thing that resonates and making it available to whomever it resonates with. And if you're ready for the message, you pick up the message. And if you're not ready for the message, then you don't see the value in the art, but then you might see the value in the next piece of art. So it's really about creating a movement, because it's really understanding that if we're going to be truly transformative, we need others.
Yes.
If you were to express your message, Case, what would you say to others in order to get the transformation going? Or perhaps you want to ask someone on earth for help on this. What would you ask and why? What is the message? What is the curiosity that drives you to want to transform?
Well, my main source of inspiration has been my Buddhist practice. Yeah, I've been practicing as a Buddhist for 30 years, and I've been part of a Buddhist school that is called Applied Buddhism. It's a school of Buddhism by Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese Zen teacher. I think the most profound lesson I've learned, basically there are two lessons. Lesson one I've learned is, you know, Buddhist practice is not the stuff that you do on a meditation kosho in the Zendo, but the stuff that you do on your office chair. And so practice, stuff like loving kindness, compassion, altruism is not the stuff that you do in a meditation retreat, but it's what you do in everyday business. So society, community is practice. Yeah. So this is fundamental. And the second thing I've learned is that everything, because everything is interconnected and interrelated, matters. And the only thing that you can do is what you can influence. Yeah? So the idea that we all have to become Jaap Korteweg and start a vegetarian butcher is a bullshit idea. Jaap did it. And basically that was his path. But that doesn't mean that if you live in, I don't know, a neighborhood and you do something really nice for the elderly people there, that is insignificant, because it's not Jaap Korteweg vegetarian butcher. And I think that is the main thing that drives me. To show people that you matter. Yeah. It doesn't matter how big or small it is. If you are aware of the interconnectedness of your being, then every action, every second of the day, even the stuff that you think, matters.
Yeah.
And that opens up huge potential and opportunities. Because you don't have to watch or wait for the government to do stuff. You don't have to watch to companies to come up with products and services to do it. Now, if you want to do that and change, start a cooperative or a common. Basically, my main source of inspiration is to re-empower people. Because we have grown accustomed with a form of powerlessness, and we have created it ourselves. We are immensely powerful, but we have to dissolve these illusions. So I really believe in viva la disillusion instead of viva la revolution.
Hear that, Carola?
and disillusion means to dissolve delusion, basically. We are deluded.
This is so wonderful. And I would almost say that you have answers for our audience, even though we always promise them to have new questions. But what I think you did super well in this podcast up until now is that you started making people question their attitudes, their behavior, their look upon the world. And I think that's what you do all around the world. So thank you so much for being in the podcast.
My pleasure.
But before we end, you know, our podcast is called Dear Future, I'm Ready. And we always ask from your perspective what you're ready for. So would you be so kind to finish the sentence, Dear Future, I'm Ready.
Dear Future, I'm ready to be vulnerable. And what I mean with this sentence is that I think a lot of the stuff that is going wrong in the world at this moment goes wrong because we want to have a sense of power over and control over our situation. And we see this all over the place now, where people perceive and present a sense of control and over, I don't know, you know, climate change. If we do this and that, then we will be successful, or COVID, you know, if we do this, do we do that? And a couple of weeks later, we see that people have to come back to the drawing board because their strategy didn't work. And so what I think is a lot more powerful is acknowledging the fact that we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, we will have to see. The only thing that we know is that if we work together and if we share the burden and if we share the knowledge and if we find each other and hold each other, chances are that whatever the outcome is, we can thrive. And I would very much invite people to stop acting as if you can control the situation and start moving with the situation as it is. Alignment. And then wonders happen.
Nice. So thank you so much, Kees. Acknowledging vulnerability is such a powerful message. So thank you for doing that with us.
My pleasure. Podcast. Thanks for having me.
It's been such a wonderful opportunity to hear your thoughts up close, to ask you questions, to share into your wisdom. So thanks so much, Kees.
My pleasure, Carola.
Dear future.
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 Dear future, I'm ready.
This is Dear Future, I'm Ready.
Dear Future, I'm Ready.